I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 9th, 2010. So there I was last weekend, enjoying the holiday, looking forward to an Independence Day party later in the afternoon. But first, as I am often wont to do, a check of the Sunday New York Times. What's this I see here? A lengthy profile of one market forecaster, a gentleman named Robert Prechter, who basically ruined my day. So here's a little taste, courtesy of the Marketplace Players, of Prechter's predictions for the U.S. economy.
We have entered a market decline of staggering proportions. Perhaps the biggest of the last 300 years. Individual investors should move completely out of the market and hold cash and cash equivalents like treasury bills for years to come. Buy and hold stock investors will be devastated in a crash much worse than the declines of 2008 and early 2009, or the worst years of the Great Depression, or the Panic of 1873. The Dow is likely to fall well below 1,000 over perhaps 5 or 6 years. The time for reckoning is near!
And yet, by Wednesday, I was seeing something completely different in the Wall Street Journal. No surprise there, of course. But listen here to pieces of a story headlined, Double Dip Fears Are Overdone.
Things can look unnecessarily gloomy the morning after the party's over. Markets needed to sober up from last year's stimulus-induced highs, but investors are succumbing to exaggerated fears of a double-dip recession. The resilience of credit markets this year is a strong plus and an important signal. Markets need to snap out of their gloom before it becomes self-fulfilling.
Now, to be fair, on any other week, you could probably reverse which paper ran what. But really, what on earth are we supposed to make out of stuff like this? Joining us, perhaps with some answers, is Felix Salmon, who blogs for Reuters and is a regular guest here on Marketplace. Hi, Felix.
Hi, Tess.
So, what?
It doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? The Wall Street Journal piece concludes that markets need to go up, otherwise they will go down.
Brilliant.
We can all take that one to the bank. That and $1.50 will buy you a cup of coffee.
This, to me, really encapsulizes why people are so freaked out about what's going on right now, because they read one thing here, they read another thing there, and nobody knows what's going on, really, right?
The New York Times piece was particularly alarmist, and all of this talk about Dow 1000, which of course is ridiculous. I mean, it's pretty much physically impossible, given where the Dow divisor is, to even get to Dow 1000. You just can't have stocks trading at that level. It's basically giving people permission to panic, and that's really not very helpful.
It's not, and frankly, I don't find any of this very helpful. But it is, you know, people do read the newspaper and they do follow things like this, despite the fact that we tell everybody, you know, your personal finances are very individual and you can't try to predict what's going to happen.
Especially not when by reading a random piece in the New York Times talking about a guy who draws lines on charts and then pulls a number out of thin air. You know, these things are not based on any real fundamental analysis. He's not an economist. Even if he was an economist, you probably shouldn't listen to him because economists are notoriously bad at forecasting anything. But this guy basically just draws lines on charts. He's an astrologer.
So, okay, is there no role for financial journalists like, say, you, Felix, or me?
Not much. It would be honestly, feel free to ignore us. And if you listen to anything, just listen to us telling you to ignore the noise. People don't benefit from reading the financial press. And insofar as they do, they need to read it incredibly critically. And the skills you need to read something like the Wall Street Journal critically are rare indeed. And you probably don't have them. And if you don't have them, you'd be better off not reading it at all.
And yet they are widely disseminated. I mean, the piece in the New York Times where, you know, they had this guy talking about Dow 1000, this remained on their most emailed list for days after it came out.
People love these doom and gloom stories, and they love to also remember that people are very risk averse. And what this guy is saying in the New York Times piece is, you know what, just keep that money in the bank, keep it under your mattress, and then it won't, you know, evaporate when the market crashes. And that's true. If you feel that you can't afford to lose this money you've worked so hard for, then sure, it makes a certain amount of sense to keep it all in cash. There's no rule which says that just because you have a certain nest egg, it needs to be invested in the stock market. And so maybe what's happening here is that people are passing this story around and they're basically saying to each other, hey, these markets are dangerous. Stocks can go down. Why don't we just ignore the stock market for the time being and not have to worry about where it's going?
What's your advice then for, you know, just the average investor, the average consumer who is bombarded by numbers, by predictions day in and day out in the middle of what is supposed to be a recovery and really doesn't know what to make of it? But you can't ignore it at the same time.
Oh, you can, and you should.
Okay.
There's really no reason to read this stuff, and if you do read it, you should treat it as some kind of spectator sport, watching all of these silly forecasters when they're certain to be wrong. No one ever gets these things right consistently. And so what you do while they're all making fools of themselves is go off down the beach and have fun and don't worry about it, because you will learn nothing of use from these pieces of journalism at all.
All right. So tell me, Felix, is the time for reckoning near, or are investors succumbing to exaggerated fears of a double dip recession?
I'll tell you that the Dow is going to be at exactly 9,437 points at the end of the year. You can quote me on that.
We'll take that one to the bank. Felix Salmon of Reuters, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steph.
And you can hear more of Felix nearly every Friday on the weekly wrap on our sister program, Marketplace. So here's one thing everyone can agree on. If we are in a recovery, it is a jobless one. More than 15 million people are out looking for work. And for those lucky enough to get an offer, it could mean they'll have to move. That is also a decision facing 1,000 workers at the General Motors plant in Shreveport, Louisiana. The plant is scheduled to close sometime in the next 2 years. So those folks either have to transfer or lose their job. Kate Archer-Kent of Red River Radio has our story.
John Hanning wakes up each morning hoping that his truck assembly plant will stay open for another day. Like other workers, he gets regular offers to transfer when positions open up at other GM plants. Hanning is 4 years away from drawing his pension, and he's decided to take a calculated gamble by not transferring before the Shreveport plant closes.
I'm scared if I wait too long, there's no plants for me to go to. And then after 2 years, I have no income through General Motors. And if I don't get to another plant, then my children don't have insurance. I'll have no money coming in.
The stakes couldn't be higher for Hanning. He'll have to transfer eventually, but he won't uproot his two daughters from the only home they've ever known. He's trying to delay his transfer for as long as possible. But if the plant closes before he transfers, he loses his job. If that happens, he worries how the family would pay bills and save for the girls' education. For Hanning, the best-case scenario would have the Shreveport plant stay open until the last possible closing date in 2012. Then he'd only have to transfer and leave his family for 2 years before he could tap his GM pension.
If I'm up in Indiana, Ohio, New York, Michigan, I can't drive home on the weekends. Something happens to one of my girls, I can't come home.
His daughter, Kara, is 15 and the athlete of the family. 12-year-old Caitlin is dad's fishing partner. His family is his first thought every time he sees a new transfer opportunity on the plant's website.
I look at that screen every morning. I call my wife up. Should I put one in? And she goes, summer's here. You know what that means.
Go, Aubrey, go, Aubrey, you got it.
Safe. Summer means Kara's softball league, and John never misses a game. On a recent evening, the family sits in the bleachers, chugging Gatorade and cheering on Kara in center field. Lisa Hanning says GM has been good to her family until now.
We don't want to move. This has been home for 28 years.
Her jaw tightens when I ask her how the family will get by. Lisa's losing her job next year. She works for a federally appointed trustee who oversees Chapter 13 bankruptcies, but he's retiring. The Hannings have thought about using Lisa's savings to pay off their mortgage, credit card debt, car loans, and payments on land they purchased in Bayou Country. They had planned to build a fishing camp for their retirement, but when John transfers, they'll need to sell their house. The equity will help pay for an apartment in John's transfer city and the remaining payments on the fishing camp. It will also allow Lisa and the girls to stay put in Louisiana while John finishes his 30 years with GM.
It's been every emotion in the book that you can think of, not knowing what's going to happen and what our future holds.
John says they've stashed away little in their girls' education fund. When he turns 49, his oldest will be heading off to college, and he'll be looking for a second career to supplement his GM pension. After the game, Kara emerges from the dugout with their bats and gear strapped to her back. She's hoping she can land a softball scholarship to help pay her way through school.
It's stressful because, like, I don't know what's going to happen, where we're going to go, how the future's going to happen. I mostly focus on what's happening now and try not too hard to think about the future.
The Hannings huddle up for a family portrait, and Caitlin starts off the typical post-game debate. Will the girls score a treat on the way home?
I want a big, huge ice cream sundae.
We're going home. Some of us do have to get up early in the morning.
You know, I wake up early in the morning.
John and Lisa are products of a plant closure themselves. They met when they were teenagers after their parents, both GM workers, were transferred to Shreveport. But the Hannings don't want to follow in their parents' footsteps. They won't make the same decision and uproot the life they've made here. It's a risk they're willing to take to be close to what's most important to them. In Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace Money.
It's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is Marketplace Money's economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
How you doing, Tess?
I am doing well. You know, we haven't spoken in a few weeks, and in that time, what has happened to interest rates? This is all happening so fast, it makes my head spin.
Oh, it's incredible. Go back to April, and the whole discussion was about the rise in interest rates and how high would interest rates go and when would the Fed start hiking its benchmark interest rate.
Right.
And take a look at the environment we're in now. Mortgage rates have never been this low. For those of you who are student borrowers, the government came out with its new numbers for the fixed rate on Stanford loans, drops from 5.6% to 4.5%. Tess, this is incredible.
You know, that's all great news for borrowers, but of course, if you're a saver, this is terrible news.
Well, this is absolutely terrible news because it's really true that you probably make as much interest putting the money in a mattress as you do by having it in the bank.
Yeah. Well, what's going on here? You know, you mentioned that things were starting to go in an upward direction just a couple of months ago. What's happened in the intervening months to send them back down?
It's two things. With all the concerns about European sovereign debt and the European debt and deficit crisis, and the other factor, which is more domestic here, is about a slowdown in our economy.
All right. Well, like I said, excellent for borrowers, bad for savers. But let's move on to another interest, and that is our interest in our callers. Mark is with us from Los Angeles, right here in La La Land. Hi, Mark.
Hi, guys.
Where do you listen to the show?
I podcast it.
Podcasting.
Yeah, it's so convenient, you know, radio on demand.
There you go. Well, so I'm going to take a wild guess here. You work in the entertainment field?
Yes.
You do?
I work in television.
So what do you work on?
My company produces like reality television shows and music award shows and television commercials, basically.
So we can blame you for Jersey Shore?
You can blame people like me for Jersey Shore.
Poor New Jersey, the housewives in New Jersey.
Yeah, there you
I go. Don't know.
You know you love it. You know you love it.
Well, so you do a lot of reality shows. Any thoughts about one that follows the chaos and excitement of personal finance advice? Chris, you up for that?
You know what? What you could call it is the new frugality.
Yes.
And
I smell a book plug.
I'm just saying that title just came to me. Yes, it is. It's the title of my book. And we could go around and deal with people as they struggle to borrow less and save more.
You sold me on it.
The New Frugality, reality TV. I like that. So have, any chance you've read the book?
I have, actually.
You have read the book?
Yeah. I borrowed it from my local library. I guess that's the downside to creating personal finance books, huh?
Hey, get out. It's wonderful. Well, I'm just so happy that you read it and other people have been reading it. So whether you buy it or you take it out of the library, that's great.
All right. Well, so have you been able to use any of Chris's tips?
Yes, I have, actually. There was a part of the book in which Chris mentions that, you know, sometimes it's worthwhile asking private universities to see if they can lower the cost of tuition for you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm actually headed back to grad school this fall. And after reading that piece in Chris's book, I just decided to, you know, shoot a little email over to the financial aid office.
How'd that go?
They shot me down, but in a very nice way, you know.
Still worth a try.
Yes. But it made me feel good, you know, like at least I asked. One question that I do have, actually, is how my student loans will affect my soon-to-be spouse. I'm getting married next year.
Oh, congratulations on your engagement.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And, you know, one scenario that ran through my mind was, well, what happens if I pass away before I can repay all of my loans? Does my wife then inherit my debt?
You are definitely in the reality-based community. Oh, we're going to the same place, Chris. This is great. I mean, I really love that he's actually thinking about how old are you, Mark?
I'm 28.
Okay, so you are a total realist. That I mean, anything could happen at any time.
It's the risk reward.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what's the answer here, Chris? Where does the liability fall if he takes on a loan with a spouse versus without a spouse?
The rules are pretty clear. If you're taking out a federal loan and you die, the debt dies with you. This is not true when it's a private loan.
Got you.
So, Mark, what kind of loans do you have?
I'm taking out all federal loans.
All federal. So you're sitting pretty.
Yes.
Well, you're not exactly sitting pretty. You got to pay it
back. You got to pay it back.
Yeah. We're going to assume that you're going to live for a long time and a wonderful marriage and a wonderful career, but you don't have to worry about saddling your wife in the unfortunate demise with a lot of debt.
Well, she'll be happy to hear that as well.
I bet she will. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And have a wonderful time planning your wedding and enjoy that honeymoon.
Thank you. And thank you so much for your help.
Great. Thanks for the question.
Bye.
All right. Up next is Michael, and he's in Harriman, New York. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. How you doing?
Very well. Very well. And you?
I'm doing great. I like the idea of the new frugality. That sounded super.
Well, I think Chris could help you out with that. Chris, the book is found at all booksellers nationwide?
At all booksellers nationwide, online booksellers, and New Frugality by Chris Farrell.
All right. And in fact, you can find a link to that on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Sounds good.
So how do you catch the show?
Usually online.
Oh, we have another podcaster.
Yes.
And what do you do there in Harriman?
I'm an actor.
Wow, well, you need to talk to Mark. Although, actually, if you're an actor, you're not doing reality television, right?
Yeah, not so much reality television.
Have you been in anything that we would recognize?
You guys would recognize me mostly from my voice work. I do a lot of voices for television commercials. Right now, I think you might know the Liberty Mutual responsibility. Mm-hmm. What's your policy?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
That's me.
You want to give us the pitch?
Yeah, the tagline is responsibility. What's your policy? But there's a lot more to a couple of the spots they go on for a while. It's a lot of fun, and they're a great group of people.
Oh,
so,
I love that. Yeah. How did you get into acting? Did you wait tables for years?
This is great. You guys are going to love this. I always wanted to act ever since I was a little kid. And in high school, I did a lot of acting, a lot of the stage shows and stuff like that. So I got the acting award to go off to college and pursue acting. And instead of acting, I thought, well, why don't I become a lawyer? And that way I'll get all kinds of acting experience in trials. And so I did that. Doesn't quite work that way.
Now, why on earth would you turn away from practicing law then?
Yeah, I just didn't fit the bill for me.
Can I ask, how old were you when you decided that you were just going to make this left turn?
33. When I decided to truly pursue it. My wife is also an actor, so it's interesting to say the least in terms of money, and that's why I contacted you guys, I guess, for a little advice.
Yeah.
Well, when you made the transition, did you have a lot of debt?
I had all kinds of debt from law school. I paid it off just before I left my legal career.
Well, if all that's gone now, are you managing your money well?
No, the short answer is definitely not well, but we're not in debt. I say not well because we have a lot of money coming in. When you're doing commercials, you get residuals or royalties, and, mm-hmm. and it kind of just flows in willy-nilly. Mm. You can't really plan on it. So you kind of just get these checks in the mail, and it's great. But I think my problem is utilizing that to the best extent possible. I don't think I've done that very well. We have a great emergency fund, but other than that, we don't have a great our retirements have been neglected. I cashed mine in 4 years ago when we bought the condo and haven't done anything since. So not managing well, but we're definitely not in any debt either.
Yeah, no, Chris, I think this is a terrific start. I mean, at least they don't have a whole lot of debt. I mean, an emergency fund, congratulations, certainly pat yourselves on the back for that. But this is a really great question because, I mean, they're actors, so they're essentially freelance workers. And there are a lot of people out there right now doing the same thing. And it's got to be a real challenge. How do you budget when you have no regular form of income?
That's right.
Exactly.
I mean, I guess you probably have a sense of how much income you're going to get over the course of a year, because essentially what you want to do, or what I would recommend doing, make some sort of guesstimate about what your salary is going to be. And you probably, do you have sort of a sense of that?
I hate to say it, but it's so fluctuating. For example, you know, last year, you know, I didn't have any big national networks running, so it was, you know, very, very little. Whereas this year with Liberty Mutual, it's been completely different, which leads me to my question, which I was thinking, is there any way, should I base it on a percentage of how much I'm making? Because I can't, the future thinking is, it's tough.
What if we sort of reverse the planning? So you know what your expenses are going to be.
Yes.
And you break that down by monthly. And then you want to put over that some sort of retirement savings. In a sense, what you're trying to do is meet those expenses plus over the course of a year. To divide it that way, so it'd be less of a percentage, but, you know, what is your expenses? Then what salary do you want to, and what's your retirement? And then what salary do you want to have above that for your sort of discretionary fund? And try managing your money that way.
Okay. Well, that's great. That's a great idea. I haven't done that before.
Hey, Chris, can I make another small suggestion?
Oh, sure.
What if he were to go through his tax forms for the last 2 or 3 years, say, mm-hmm. and figure out which year they made the least amount of money as a family and live on that?
Yeah, I think it's a very good idea. I mean, that really does give you a sense of the fluctuation. And 3 years is probably the right time frame test.
Yeah.
5 years starts to get a little bit along.
Sure.
And things can really shift over that period of time. That's a really good idea. I like that a lot.
Oh, thank you. So Michael, I do have to ask, given that you are not only an attorney, but also an actor, were you ever on Law & Order?
I haven't done Law & Order yet.
I think my producer has just been waiting for the opportunity to do that.
That's great.
All right, Michael, I think you've got some first steps here, and good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much, and I really appreciate the help.
All right, and we'll be listening for your voice on the commercials.
Oh, please do.
Okay, one more. All right, that's enough. Thanks, Michael.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, time for another caller, Chris. And we've got Linda on the line from beautiful Santa Ana, California. Hi, Linda.
Hi there.
How are you doing today?
Great. How are you guys?
Doing very well. And where do you listen to us?
KPCC and online.
Now, from what I understand, you could probably give a little acting advice to Michael.
Well, it's more real life than acting. I'm an investigator for the public defender. So we represent people that are accused of crimes, and I investigate on their behalf.
You sound really nice. Have you ever had to deal with some really dangerous situations?
There's some hairy situations, but for the most part, you're still dealing with people, and being real and just reachable makes it easier.
Do you ever watch The Good Wife on CBS?
I've seen it, yes. And there's a female investigator on the show who's pivotal to cracking a lot of the cases, and that's pretty much what I do.
And do you wear really, really tight, short leather skirts like she does?
No. No, because that gets you the wrong kind of attention in the field, and you need to get in and out of the car without being noticed.
So are you going over some of the same questions and issues the police dealt with, but you're asking them slightly differently, or with a different eye?
Yes, actually, since we're working hand in hand with the defense lawyers, we're looking to support whatever the defense theory is, re-interview witnesses more or find more witnesses.
Now, have you been able to use your skills then in your own life? I bet nobody gets anything over on you, huh?
I have, and I'll tell you, it actually pertains to the reason that we're talking is I'm a first-time homeowner, and the home that I purchased was a foreclosure.
Oh, wow.
There was a lot of backdoor deals that I didn't understand, and so being an investigator helped me tap into resources, look further into issues.
I bet you're really good at a paper trail.
Yes, I actually don't like the paper trail as much as I do talking to people and asking questions.
Yeah. So how did that go? I mean, we've had a lot of stories, show, about what it's like to buy a foreclosed home. And for the most part, people hate the process.
And I agree with all of that. Fortunately for me, we had one situation go badly, and I was able to contact somebody at the bank, and I actually called for our guardian angel because, in fact, the next home we did try to purchase and we ended up purchasing was owned by that same bank. Hmm. And whenever we hit a glitch in the process, I'd call her and she would look into things and sort of smooth things over for us. And it was very frustrating, but luckily we had somebody on our side.
Well, so it sounds like it all went well.
So that all went well, and we got a great loan. But I was sort of curious about a week ago, and I started looking at the current interest rates, and I found that I could probably get a loan for about a point less than what our current loan is.
Chris, this is exactly what we were talking about at the top of the segment.
That's right.
Right. So my current loan's like 4.875, and it looks like you can get a 15-year fix for 3.875.
Good Lord.
And I started to look into it, and Wells Fargo currently owns my loan, and they offered this thing that they call the HARP program.
Hmm.
It's under the stimulus package, and I qualify for it. And I told them, you know, really, I'm not in a financial hardship. I don't want to take a credit ding for having to sort of restructure a loan. They said, no, you don't have to worry about any of that. And the good thing about that program is that you actually don't have to go through escrow and all of the things that you normally do through a traditional refinance.
Wow. Yeah. Chris, what do you know about this program? Is it HARP or is it HAMP?
It's HARP, and this is the Home Affordable Refinance Program. The basic thrust of this program has been for those homeowners who cannot refinance because the value of their home is down. It's not a bad program, but I'm just wondering in your circumstances, you know, whether we should be thinking about a 15-year at, what did you say, 3.8%?
3.8, yeah.
That's astounding.
You're almost not paying any interest at that point.
Linda, what kind of mortgage are you in now? Is it a 15 or 30?
It's a 15-year fixed, but what was attractive to me about the HARP is, as painful as I said the foreclosure purchase was, the financing end of it was a bigger headache. So I swore I would never purchase a home again just to avoid the whole escrow process. So HARP was tempting for two reasons. A, I would bypass that entire process.
Yeah.
And B, there are no fees associated with it. It's an absolutely no-fee process. The rate that you get, though, is higher. So they offered me 4.35, whereas if I go through a traditional refinance, it would be 3.8.
Oh, interesting. So you're actually not gaining a lot by going through the HARP program then?
Not a whole lot, about a half a point, but without headaches.
Versus a full point if you don't.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is just simple math. Depending on where the numbers lie, then there's sort of a psychological issue.
Right.
Unless it's worth the hassle, then I would just go ahead and do the HARP. But if it turns out the numbers are dramatic enough because of the compounding effect even over 15 years, you know, then you take a deep breath. I've dealt with more troubled situations than this, but I have a feeling you're going to end up just refinancing a HARP 15-year. Half a percentage point is half a percentage point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, right. Okay, and I just wanted to run it by you because I always listen to your show, and my husband does too. And if we miss it on the air, we run it online. And so we figured, well, before we make this big decision, let's run it by you guys.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. You keep listening to the show for financial advice, and if, God forbid, I ever get into a little legal snafu, I'm giving you a call.
All right. Hope I can help.
Okay, it's a deal.
All right.
Thanks, Linda.
Bye-bye.
All right. Whether it's investigating a better deal for your future, your student loan, or your 401k, do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or email your question. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Hey, Chris, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
It's been great. Thanks, Des.
And remember to check with your own financial expert before making any big money decisions. Tried getting attention from your bank lately? A lot of people with mortgages have, and we've heard the stories of how that goes. Well, here's a novel strategy that's the street equivalent of snapping your fingers in front of the CEO's face. Bring all your furniture and other things from the house that's about to be foreclosed on and try to move into the high-rise office of a bank executive. It happened this week here in Los Angeles, and our senior business correspondent Bob Moon went to see if it got the attention of the good people at JPMorgan Chase. Quite the publicity stunt, eh, Bob?
Uh-huh, and a confrontational one at first, as you might expect, Tess. A crowd of maybe 50 demonstrators.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
And a U-Haul truck backs up to this office tower and unloads not really all their furniture, just a couple of easy chairs, a table and lamp, an inflatable mattress.
We brought this to let you know you continue to put us out of our homes. We will move into your home.
That was community activist Lynn Motley. She was there demanding to know why Deborah and Tommy Beard had been kept negotiating over 2 years for an affordable loan modification. Mr. Beard told me their payments were lowered temporarily, but now they're back in foreclosure.
We can afford to make the payments that they gave us for the trial modification, and that's what we want. Not the triple payments that they presented to us, and we can't afford that. That's over our paychecks, both of ours together.
Now, I have to ask, Bob, you say this has been going on for a couple of years?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, did they succeed in getting the bank executives to, you know, come down and explain?
Well, not the chairman of Chase California, Peter Barker, but the bank did send down a spokesman, Gary Kishner. And he sounded almost apologetic about the runaround these folks have gotten when they've called at different times and heard conflicting promises and advice. He as much as admitted that's been happening, and he suggested the most effective way to request a loan modification is face-to-face at one of the special Chase home ownership centers that the bank is located in hard-hit areas of the country.
We invite, please, we beg borrowers to please, if you're in trouble, set up an appointment, come in and meet with a counselor. That counselor will be your single point of contact throughout the process.
And those centers are on the Chase.com website, and we'll link to them online here at Marketplace.
And how did that go over with the homeowners there?
Well, the bank's people really pushed this idea. Listen to what happened when a boy named Angel Martinez grabbed the microphone to help his mother.
When she was talking on the phone, they said she was one of the families that qualifies.
Oh, no, esa es una aplicación vieja.
When she called again, they said that it was an old application, application, and she needed to fill out new information.
Ask your mom, does she have all the information with her?
Yes, she does.
Okay. Can you come now? Right from here, we can go over to the branch. It's a block away. We have a loan counselor that we brought him in from the loan center, and we can sit down and look at your case.
It sounds like a happy ending, maybe?
Well, I'd like to end on an upbeat note, Tess, but I asked the Chase spokesman about the flip side of that.
In the case of a lot of these people, is it possible they just simply are in homes they cannot afford?
Yes. Yes, it is possible.
The answer may ultimately be that you cannot keep your home.
Our priority is to keep people in their homes. If we're not able to do that, we review their options. Sometimes it's the short sale. Sometimes it's a deed in lieu of foreclosure. But we try to educate the borrower on what their options are if modification is not an option. From there, it's their decision on what course of action they're going to take.
Now, a short sale, by the way, is when the mortgage holder allows the homeowner to sell it for less than they owe.
Right.
And that typically forgives the remainder of the loan. That deed in lieu of foreclosure he was talking about is when the borrower and the mortgage holder agree to just have the homeowner sign the property back over to the lender.
So you don't get to keep your home, but you don't necessarily have to go through a foreclosure, which, of course, is far more damaging to things like your credit score.
That's right. Sad story to tell either way.
Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tess.
Raise your hand, please, if you are a cheapskate. Don't want to admit it publicly? Well, why not? Because people might think you're a cheapskate? Well, welcome to the year 2010, where being a cheapskate wins you all kinds of plaudits and a book deal. With us to talk about his new book, The Cheapskate Next Door, is Jeff Yeager. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tess.
Now, I have to tell you, I would never be accused of being a cheapskate, but I'm not sure I would want someone to call me one, even if I were.
We can get you some help, Tess. The first step is to admit that you have a spending problem. Don't take it at face value. I consider being a cheapskate to be a virtue. In fact, among other surprise findings of the people I surveyed, they tend to be twice as generous in their charitable giving as the average American.
Wow. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells you a lot. These are people who do something very un-American. They live happily below their means. So they're not just spending less than they make, which, of course, is not the American norm, sadly, these days. But, in fact, they're happier because of it.
Well, let's talk about some tricks of living cheaply and or frugally. Let's start with you. I'd like to hear some of your favorite tricks for saving more than you spend.
For instance, mykidseatfree.com is a great website of thousands of restaurants around the country where, you know, if you're a parent, you buy a meal, your kids will eat for free. Huh. Freecycle.org is a tremendous nonprofit worldwide network where people give away free stuff they no longer want in order to keep it out of the landfill. I surveyed and interviewed over 300 cheapskates. And what I found was some really surprising stuff about their attitude towards money and life. One of the things being that they have a high degree of self-confidence. As I say, in their words, the Joneses can kiss our assets. We don't care what the Joneses think of us. We're largely brand blind and advertising averse. We're not compelled to go out and buy the latest gadget just because of a fancy brand name. Interestingly, the cheapskates value quality and durability even more than price, but they kind of do a matrix in their head of how those things factor in together. Here's a very telling thing. The average American regrets about 80% of the discretionary purchases they make every year.
80%?
The cheapskates, they at least have some regrets about those discretionary purchases. They might go out and do it again. But, you know, buyer's remorse is an epidemic in our society. Of the cheapskates polled, only about 10% of their purchases were something that they eventually regret.
Boy, that's going to prompt me to go out and as I buy things, I'm going to try to track how much regret I have after I get
them. Yeah, and I always write about a lot of practical tips in that regard. Tess, you have a problem, so let me help you here, Tess. You should start
a
mandatory.
I'm not going to tell you that I waited in line for the new iPhone.
Please don't. Yeah, you may be past the point of return. Have your own mandatory waiting period of, say, a week between the time you see a discretionary item in the store and when you go back to buy it. It's particularly new of new technology because, as we know, technology tends to drop in price and increase in quality the longer it's been out. So to quote Elvis, only fools rush in when it comes to rushing out to buy that latest tech gadget.
Did you hear any stories of cheapness that you kind of went, you know what, even I would not go that far?
Well, I have a neighbor who is aghast that I, every couple of years, pay somebody a couple hundred bucks to clean out my septic tank. He cleans his out himself, all 520 buckets worth. And Tess, he wonders why we never invite him over for dinner. Oh, the poor thing. You know, there are stories of the bizarre cheapskate behavior in there. One nice older lady who told me that she saves her used Q-tips to detail the inside of her car with.
Oh, they have no, she does not.
Tess, unfortunately, she told me that as she was driving me around. But that's all charming, quirky stuff, and I don't want to give the wrong impression of the book. The backbone of the book, The Cheapskate Next Door, is that there is somebody out there with a family situation just like yours, and they're able to do it by spending less than they make.
Jeff Yeager is the author of The Cheapskate Next Door, The Surprising Secrets of Americans Living Happily Below Their Means. Thanks so much. It's been fun chatting with you.
Thanks, Tess. Stay cheap.
So here's where you might expect us to ask for your cheapskate tips. Well, actually, no. We want your stories of when being a cheapskate completely backfired. Like you bought a $5 table at a garage sale only to spend $500 refinishing it. We will share our favorites on the show next week. And the best story gets Carl Castle on their answering machine. Wait, no, we can't do that. How about a limited edition Marketplace Money piggy bank? Go to marketplace.org and click on the piggy bank for your chance to win. Time time now for your comments about what you've heard on our show. Let's start with the really important stuff first, shall we? And I'm talking about beer.
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 Our friends Rico and Brendan from the Dinner Party Download joined us last week for a discussion of how to win best 4th of July party honors. Their suggestion was go big and expensive with a 32-proof Scottish brew or cheap but reliable American brew like, say, Bud. Hark, writes Alex Lang of Hotmail.com. Yes, he actually said hark and didn't tell us where he's from. Budweiser, as I suspect you know, Tess, is now owned by a Belgian conglomerate run by a bunch of Brazilians. This is not a beer to hoist on the day we celebrate our independence. May I herewith suggest one of the multitude of independent quality microbrews multiplying even now throughout these United States. Yes, you may herewith, and may I herewith suggest one of the multitude from my home state of Oregon. Consumer columnist Cheryl Harris of the Cleveland Plain Dealer joined us recently to talk about scams. One of them was familiar to listener Luann Galanti of Charlotte, North Carolina. She put an air conditioner up for sale on Craigslist. Someone in Tennessee offered to send $300 for it.
The needle on my bogus meter started dancing and later received another email that a mistake had been made and the check had been cut for $3,000. Would I please deposit the check and send the money order back for the $2,700? I took the check and emails to the bank. They said it was under federal investigation and thanked me very much for bringing it to them.
And last week we reported on a study that shows that physically touching money makes people feel stronger and more pain tolerant. Kiana Harris of Chicago, Illinois, posed this follow-up.
Does this mean that bank clerks and grocery cashiers, both who touch money all day, every day, are the happiest and most confident people in our society?
Probably not. Wait, banks still have clerks? And Patricia Nakamura of Muskego, Wisconsin, wanted some more specifics.
Did the subjects handle paper money or coins? And secondly, what denominations were used? Did a $100 bill make people feel better than did a $1 bill?
Well, the study's author, Kathleen Voss, at the University of Minnesota, says coins do not elicit the same response as paper currency. And they used tens and twenties to generate that warm, happy feeling. Our warm, happy feelings come when you write to us. Leave your comments, compliments, and complaints at marketplace.org. All right, we've had plenty of fun already this week with my financial habits, what with cheapskate Jeff Yeager offering more than once to get me into a program. So why not go a step further and introduce my husband, Dan? Here we present a recreation of a conversation the two of us had a couple of weeks ago. Hello, dear. You look handsome today.
Well, thank you. I hope you had a great day.
I did. What do you want to do with our credit card points?
What are the choices?
Well, for 12,000 points, we can get $100 cash back. For 14,000 points, we can get a $100 gift card to Amazon or iTunes or any number of your favorite retailers.
Gift card, please.
Okay, but you understand we are giving up more points for the exact same amount of money. 2,000 points, in fact, which equals $2,000 that we spent.
Gift card, please.
Yes, dear. Seriously, that's pretty close to how it went. And it's the kind of interaction that leads us to ask...
Let me start with question number one. What the hell were you thinking?
What were you thinking? It is our look at why we do what we do with our money. And today I'm joined by Suzanne Hsu. She's a marketing professor at UCLA's Business School. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, so what is this? And I will say right off the bat that... You know, honestly, had I made this decision and not left it to my husband to make the decision, I probably would have done the same thing, which makes absolutely no financial sense whatsoever. But I want that gift card.
From an economist's point of view, you're absolutely right. It just doesn't make sense because cash can be just as good as a gift card, if not better, because you can spend it anywhere.
Right. Or you can pay down that credit card bill.
Absolutely. It's what we call fungibility. Cash is much more fungible. It allows you to spend it on a lot of other things you need. The problem that we all have, and this goes back quite a ways in the behavioral economics literature, one of the first papers in behavioral economics written by Richard Thaler was on an idea called mental accounting. The problem that we face as consumers is that we need to exert self-control on our finances. And so what he hypothesized was something that you see a lot of people do, which was mentally take that income and put it into buckets.
Hmm.
This is the money for my rent. This is the money for my groceries. This is the money to go out and have fun with. And by doing that, we can control our spending a little bit.
Even if we're not actually consciously thinking about that, we're just kind of doing that in our heads.
Absolutely. So if you go back, people would actually put cash in envelopes marked with these titles. Now, today we have credit cards. But mentally, we're still doing this. We're still trying to control our spending and hit that right balance between having fun and not going overboard.
So where do the buckets come into this decision to, with our points, buy a gift card? Because you really are kind of buying it, rather than the same amount going right back to pay that credit card.
If you took the money as cash, either to pay the credit card or just somehow put into your larger bucket of income for the month, mm-hmm. so to speak, then it gets mixed in and it could end up going towards the mortgage. It could end up going towards the groceries. And that
That's
just doesn't
boring.
Feel exactly. Exactly. What fun is that? Whereas if you put it towards a gift card, you've set up a new account of, wow, this is something I earned, and now I get to go have fun with it. And there's also a lot of findings in marketing and behavioral economics that when people feel like they've earned a reward, like frequent flyer miles or other things
like a
gift card.
That's totally what it feels like. It's my reward
exactly.
for spending money.
Exactly. So you want to go out and have fun with it. And putting it into a gift card is your way of saying, I am making sure that this reward I've earned goes towards something fun. You get to go out and relax your self-control rule.
But again, you know, and I have to point this out multiple times because I'm just baffled by my brain on this. We had to spend $2,000 more to get the 2,000 more points to get a gift card instead of the same amount of money in cash back on the card.
That's true. But what you're doing is really paying for that loophole in your self-control in some sense.
There's a price for everything, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Well, I guess that is what we were thinking. Suzanne Hsu has been with us. She's a marketing professor just down the street at UCLA. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, ever tried to call your health insurance company to get some answers?
You don't know how many consumers will immediately try to find what's the one number that's going to get me out of this box and into a live agent.
Absolutely. Do you do it? You're laughing because you do it, aren't you?
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Laura Dine Million. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.